Hello and welcome to The Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. It's Friday, and so Brett Ehrlich, host of the Happy Half Hour, is here.
Two big announcements. Happy Half Hour. Sloan Hughes from Funny or Die is on tonight at 7.
Awesome.
On our offerings. A lot of cool stuff's happening with Happy Half Hour. Members, stay tuned for more announcements.
What? I don't know about this.
Really cool stuff in terms of making it easier on you to watch it.
Oh.
Not from a content standpoint. It will still be insufferable.
Not less annoying and offensive.
But just from a logistical standpoint, it'll be easier.
Okay.
Second, Sunday night at 9 p.m. on ABC, Brett Ehrlich will be on The Year. So it just set it and forget it. You don't have to watch it, but if you DVR it, go back and play it through without pausing so we get the ratings.
Yeah. I've never seen one of those like as it's happening, and I really would like to this year. I think that would be very interesting.
It's an interesting experience watching someone who's a trailblazer in new media on a traditional media setting. I like to make waves, and I make a lot of waves, John. I don't know. We sit there and shoot for like 3 hours. I thought that what is the drink that I thought the White Claws was going to be a thing, so I brought them to the shoot. They were like, we can't show alcohol like that on TV. So the producer and I just drank White Claws and told jokes. It'll be really fun.
So based on my experience with White Claw, expect something.
But you get involved and tweet them how happy you are that someone from a TYT and you know a progressive media outlet was involved.
We should start a hashtag.
Even if most of it was to talk about Sharpiegate and more lighthearted.
Oh, Sharpiegate, I forgot about that. Okay, so we got a lot of stuff planned, so much so that why don't we just get into it, okay?
Yeah.
Last night at the debate, there were a number of good moments. One that really stood out for me was Bernie Sanders talking about climate change and linking our lack of action and inability to do what we need to do with the incredible amount of money that we and others are spending on the military. But it led to a fact check that I found very frustrating. First, here is Bernie Sanders.
In all due respect, your question misses the mark. It is not an issue of relocating people in towns. The issue now is whether we save the planet for our children and our grandchildren. The issue, as you should know, what the scientists are telling us is they have underestimated the threat and severity of climate change. You're talking about the Paris Agreement, that's fine, ain't enough. We have got to, and I've introduced legislation to do this, declare a national emergency. The United States has got to lead the world. And maybe, just maybe, instead of spending $1.8 trillion a year globally on weapons of destruction, maybe an American president, i.e. Bernie Sanders, can lead the world. Instead of spending money to kill each other, maybe we pool our resources and fight our common enemy, which is climate change.
Thank you, Senator Sanders.
I thought that was great. That was exactly what I wanted to hear. And I had sort of made a similar sort of point last night that like saying like, yeah, I'm gonna put us back in the climate accords. Like, so? Yeah, obviously you're gonna do that. I'm gonna increase subsidies for solar and wind. Duh, what are you talking, you're bragging about that at this point?
Yeah, everything from that through the Green New Deal is an investment in a major shift in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a good one, and it's one we can lead. We already lead in military spending. We already are the coolest and biggest.
We have the best.
Whatever measuring contest you want
to make. We can make things blow up big.
We are the killiest.
Mm-hmm. So no one kills more or better.
So we can do that. But this is one of those things that's so frustrating because the way it is written off so quickly by people who say, how can we pay for it? I get that initial instinct. That initial instinct that says, like, you're just describing a disaster movie. Mm-hmm. And those starred Arnold Schwarzenegger. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of CGI. But it's like, no, it's not exactly like that. But we know where it's headed. And we can make an investment the way we invest in so much other stuff to safeguard ourselves and in the meantime, make a lot of money off of it.
Yeah.
Because all of the stuff that we take for granted now was invested in by the government, whether it's trying to go to space and all the technological advancements that came from being like, oh, we should make stuff smaller so we can put it on an aircraft and still get to the moon or spacecraft and get to the moon. The same way we are investing in technologies that, yes, will put us ahead of the curve when it comes to climate change initiatives and safeguarding our resources, but also be practically applicable later in other ways.
Yeah.
God, Brett's smart.
And you're so smart. And obviously, if you are facing a huge threat, you don't want it to hit you, so you ward it off. But along the way, not only we'll be making jobs, but everything will be more efficient, more sustainable, healthier, like cleaner, all of that. Every one of these improvements is an improvement outside of even its impact on stopping climate change.
But just to put one extra spin on it, like you say that, like I have a friend who's a very conservative businessman, you know, that feeling when you talk to them. And he goes, all this Al Gore climate stuff's a scam anyway. And it's like, well, from your perspective, good. Like this is an opportunity for you to take advantage of government subsidies. Yeah. Well, that's the same way that people you, as a small business owner, are jealous of the large businesses that benefit from these kind of industry-wide investments that the government is making. If you think it's a scam, take advantage of it the same way you would take advantage of everything else.
All the other
scams. Your credo.
Yeah, and they've been talking about energy independence for so long. What if we could just make all of our energy from the light that's hitting us and the wind that's blowing around? Wouldn't that be great to be independent that way? But anyway, Bernie Sanders did make one fatal error, and it's that he used a number, and he's gonna be slapped down for that. Because what we have, so we have fact checkers, okay? They are here to help us decide what is true and what is not true. Ideally, sometimes it's used for something else, and this is a good case of that. So he said that $1.8 trillion was spent on weapons so that we can destroy each other. And so I saw this. This is tweeted out by a CNN reporter. So fact check, Sanders was speaking imprecisely. The $1.8 trillion figure represents all global military spending in 2018, not spending on weapons in particular. It's also on bases and uniforms and vehicles and healthcare for the soldiers and all that. Yep, those are all things you need to have the military that is using the weapons to blow each other apart. It has nothing to do with what he's saying. It's still a dollar, you know, what's that classic thing? Every dollar spent on blah, blah, blah isn't a dollar that goes into the mouth of a child and all that. Mm. It still isn't going into the mouth.
Yeah.
It's still being spent on the military. This is how more and more people have been identifying that fact checking can, in the worst of times, be used as an ideological weapon to pretend that a point is not true because you have some sort of little technical problem with the exact way that something was phrased. His point was 100% accurate.
Yeah, it's very clear to me, and I think very clear to reasonable people. And I'm glad that CNN has people doing this kind of stuff, though.
Because I generally am.
No, I mean, the more I was listening to some CNN coverage of the debate on the way home after the debate, because we all stayed here. Thank you, everybody, for watching.
Thank you.
But the coverage, like there was one time, I forget her name, but one of their senior analysts like couldn't even say the whole name Bernie Sanders. Mm-hmm. Like the revolution, she goes like, oh, these people who aren't ready for the revolutions, like the ones from Warren and and then she just moves on. Like she couldn't even say it because they have such contempt for the concept like this. And so that's why they pounce on things like this that I would say probably what's more accurate, like more of a thing to fact check if he says a number that is wrong. Mm-hmm. This is a number that's right.
Like if the number was actually 600 billion.
She was like, okay. We spent a good, literally $7 gajillion. Mm-hmm. And what's frustrating is like, do they still fact check like Trump in that way where they go, and sometimes they do, but the defense is like of Trump when he lies is, well, that was hyperbole on purpose. Mm-hmm. And Bernie's like, no, that all made sense in every way. You're trying to spin it in a way that is a distinction without a difference.
Exactly.
They try to drop like, this is correlation is not causation. It's like, you have given a distinction without a difference.
Exactly.
If you wanna crawl up each other's you know, speech and debate butts.
Exactly. Let's turn to one other thing that cropped up during yesterday's debate. So at one point, Joe Biden at the debate was talking about some of the people that he's talked to in his own selfie lines. And while Joe was describing some of these people that he's met, he used a particular turn of phrase that Sarah Huckabee Sanders had an issue with, and everyone had an issue with her. So here is Joe last night.
You're not the only one that does selfies, Senator. I've done thousands of them, thousands of them. And the crew that follows me can tell you, there's not one line I go through that I don't have at least a half a dozen people come up and hug me and say, can you help me? I just lost my daughter 10 days ago. Can you help me? Tell me I'm going to be okay. Can you help me? I just lost. And they go and lay out their problems. My wife and I have a call list of somewhere between 20 and 100 people that we call at least every week or every month to tell them I'm here. I give them my private phone number. They keep in touch with me. The little kid who says I can't talk. What do I do? I have scores of these young women and men who I keep in contact with. And the reason I would give everyone here a gift is they want to do something like I do.
Okay, so there he's describing people he keeps in touch with, and he obviously stuttered there. Now, I think most people watching probably noticed that, but not everyone tweeted as Sarah Huckabee Sanders did, I have absolutely no idea what Biden is talking about. And so if that seems needlessly cruel, that's because it was. Because if she had just waited a moment, she might learn, as most people did, that Joe Biden worked his entire life to overcome a stutter. And it's his great honor to mentor kids who have experienced the same. It's called empathy. Sarah, look it up. So he tweeted that at her. I didn't know that he had been working on a stutter and that he was mentoring people who have done the same. Like, look, I don't agree with Joe Biden on a number of things. I don't support him in the primary. But this seems like an odd area to attack him on. And she did.
I mean, I get the instinct, and we were in a room
to mock.
The instinct to go after Biden's lack of finesse on the stage. Mm-hmm. A lot of people are like, you're old, you look old, you look like you're falling apart out there.
Yes.
I would have suggested that at some point someone in an earlier debate literally look at Biden and go like, are you okay? And yeah, I think that would have been a very big moment on the stage. And it would have been the kind of thing that sticks with him the same way Wine Cave is starting to stick with Buttigieg that you just can't get away from.
Yeah.
But she should know, A, that Biden has been working on a stutter. She should have listened because Biden literally said that a kid came up to him and then did the stutter and said, I can't talk.
Yeah, it was
that was
contextual.
In there. Yeah. All that information was there. But like for Sarah Huckabee Sanders, she did the very thing that when she was press secretary, she would accuse wrongfully in her case, but the same things that she would accuse the media of doing, which is you're willfully taking this out of context. Oh, you're attacking him for just like the way he is and how he mm-hmm. talks and what he's like. At least she did apologize.
Yes. So let's turn to that because that does not often happen. She responded to Joe Biden's tweet saying, I actually didn't know that about you and that is commendable. I apologize and should have made my point respectfully. There is no way to make that point respectfully because the entire point was just how I'm being cruel and mocking him. That's what the goal was. You want right wingers to retweet it because you're being cruel. But she did apologize. That almost never happens. I would not have predicted that that would happen. So minimal credit at least to someone on the right for apologizing when they've been needlessly cruel.
And Sarah Bear, this is a great opportunity for you to make that point. So we're still waiting for what your point was.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
Exactly. Exactly. Okay, so we have to take a break. We come back. A guest is going to join us. We'll see you in just a few.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of Unfucking the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it,
"You must unlearn what you have learned."
And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now is congressional candidate for Oregon's 1st District, Amanda Seabee. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Very glad to have you on. And there's a number of topics that we'd like to cover with you, including your platform and your opponents in this race. But we did notice one thing on your website that we found interesting. It says that if elected, you would like to join the squad as the only disabled woman in the US House and a voice for the disability rights and injured workers. Can you tell us a little bit about that, about what disability would bring and why the representation in elected office would be important?
Of course, 1 in 5 voters across the nation and 1 in 4 here in Oregon are living with some form of disability. Yet we've been left out of the conversation for way too long. I mean, if you look at the ADA hasn't really been updated since 1994, and a majority of our country is still inaccessible to those with disabilities. I mean, we need to do better to upgrade our society, include people, and make sure that everybody has a voice and representation.
So if elected, what are some of the changes perhaps in updating the ADA that you would like to institute?
I mean, we need to go to a stair-free society. A majority of homes have at least one stair going up to them, and it makes it incredibly challenging when you go over as a disabled person to a friend's house and you can't get in. You're isolated, and you can't get around. And I mean, when somebody has a home, they buy a home, and then they become disabled, then they're either forced to spend massive money on upgrades or they have to sell their home and move. We have to do better as a society. There are still trains, stores, streets, sidewalks that are completely inaccessible. We look around and we don't see disabled people around, but it's not because we don't exist. It's because we live in an inaccessible world.
Yeah, and I think that there is likely quite a bit of overall, like specific ignorance, but also overall ignorance as to how disability can shape a person's life, why that diversity in elected office would matter. I mean, so in our research, we saw that you were diagnosed in 2012 with reflex sympathetic dystrophy. And I have to admit, I'm actually not familiar with that condition, but I know that it has helped to shape your politics since your diagnosis. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, most people actually aren't, even though it's more common than breast cancer, you know? We just have no idea what reflex sympathetic dystrophy, also known as complex regional pain syndrome, is a nerve disorder where the nerves in my body, they break down due to inflammation. And as they do, they release the most intense pain signals that they can muster. So there's a 0 to 50 scale where you rank pain. It's called the McGill pain scale. And like a 17 is a toothache, and 32 is childbirth, and 41 is cutting off part of your body without anesthesia, and CRPS or RSD is 42. It tops out the scale. And yet we have patients that are living like with that type of pain that are at risk of losing opiate pain management because our government is taking an extreme reaction to the problem we're having with heroin and illicit fentanyl overdoses.
I can't even imagine what it must be like. But let's turn now to the race. So you are running with two opponents in this race, Democratic incumbent Suzanne Bonamici and Ricky Barajas. So in terms of your platform, the way you're campaigning, what are you bringing to the race that you believe sets yourself apart from those other two?
I am here as a regular person. I live on $735 a month in Social Security disability. I rely on social programs to function. I rely on public transportation to get around. I know the problems that we are facing. I live them on a daily basis. And we need that type of voice represented in our government. I mean, Bonamici, before she was elected to office, even into Congress, was worth $4 million. And now she's up to $6 million. I mean, I don't know about you, but I've never really met somebody worth that much money. I mean, all my friends are living in rent-controlled housing. I mean, we need to do better to represent the average people in our district and in our country.
And so if you are elected, what are some of the big proposals that you'd like to be a part of? What are some of the core parts of your platform that you'd like to see put into law if you enter Congress?
Medicare for all is a big thing for me. I want to ensure that we have coverage for all conditions, all medications, all treatments, all people, and all parts of the body. You know, we need to make sure that our healthcare is universal, because we shouldn't have patients fighting for the right to live. We need to ensure that there is housing, that we have guaranteed housing, that we make sure that Social Security disability, and supplemental social income are all living wage programs. We have 554,000 homeless people in this country. And just by making those three programs a living wage, we'd be able to cut that number in over half and raise the quality of life for 81 million people. We'd also reduce the reliance on social programs like food stamps and LEAP and Section 8 housing to free those up for other people, so that we can raise the quality of life for everyone. And that's what this is all about. We need to make sure that everybody is entitled to a basic standard of living.
And where can people find out more about your candidacy?
www.cb2020.com.
Amanda Seabee, thank you so much for joining us on the show today.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. We're going to take a short break here. When we come back, lots more to get to. Christianity Today is an evangelical magazine that recently came out with an editorial calling for Donald Trump to be removed from office. And Donald Trump did not take kindly to that. But before we get to his reaction, I want to show you a little bit of what's in the article. It is available to read for free. You can find it online. But they said this, and first, before getting into the arguments against Donald Trump, they put it in context of what they had written during the two past impeachments, both of which they were supportive of. So this is to some extent consistent. But they say, in 1998, we wrote this: the president's failure to tell the truth, even when cornered, rips at the fabric of the nation. This is not a private affair. For above all, social intercourse is built on a presumption of trust. Trust that the milk your grocer sells you is wholesome and pure. Trust that the money you put in your bank can be taken out of the bank. Trust that your babysitter, firefighters, clergy, and ambulance drivers will all do their best. And while politicians are notorious for breaking campaign promises, while in office, they have a fundamental obligation to uphold our trust in them and to live by the law. And this, unsavory dealings and immoral acts by the president and those close to him have rendered this administration morally unable to lead. Unfortunately, the words that we applied to Mr. Clinton 20 years ago apply almost perfectly to our current president. Whether Mr. Trump should be removed from office by the Senate or by popular vote next election, that is a matter of prudential judgment. That he should be removed, we believe, is not a matter of partisan loyalties, but loyalty to the creator of the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm. I mean,
they're taking it up to the big man, the man in charge.
I mean, you should have no other gods before your God. That's like the first. Mm-hmm. I am the Lord your God. Oh God, I remember all of them. You shall have no other gods before me. That, and then false idols. Like, if you go to a Trump rally, that's all I see. Mm-hmm. When I see Emma go report at those Trump rallies, and then any B-roll that I see of just crowds, it's a lot of people that are taking Trump's word above A, sanity, and B, in this case, it's pointed out pretty accurately by Christianity Today, the word of the Lord, amen. Mm-hmm. And to say, yeah, and Trump's responses are almost as hilarious mm-hmm. as anything I've ever seen from him.
Yeah, yeah, and we're gonna get to them. But yeah, I mean, even Jeff Van Drew yesterday, the Democrat that switched over to supporting Donald Trump, said he pledged his undying loyalty. You can't, maybe I'm crazy, but you can't do that to a person. You can pledge your dying loyalty, you're so loyal you'll even die, but your loyalty beyond death is something that you can really only pledge to like a creator, because it has a spiritual component. And yet they do treat him as if he is like a God figure. And he can blaspheme and they really don't seem to care.
By the undying, maybe he meant the undead, like a zombie like.
You can bring me back.
After you've taken all humanity and life spark from me, I will still mindlessly gobble brains.
That might be it. Okay, so a little bit more of their arguments specifically about Donald Trump. They say this president has dumbed down the idea of morality in his administration. He has hired and fired a number of people who are now convicted criminals. He himself has admitted to immoral actions in business and his relationship with women, about which he remains proud. His Twitter feed alone, with its habitual string of mischaracterizations, lies, and slanders, is a near perfect example of a human being who is morally lost and confused.
I don't think that's true. I don't think he's morally lost and confused. I think he, I mean, when you say lost as in like all is lost, there is no following him in this in fierce vein. Like,
Anakin, you've gone to a place I cannot follow.
Exactly.
Yes.
Like that by that, but it's, I think he's found exactly where he wants to be morally, and I don't think he's confused at all. I think he is single-minded and has it figured out. Obviously, he has it figured out.
He's
become president of the United States.
I think he's lost from the point of view of someone who actually like cares about and respects what they believe the will of God is.
Yeah.
But yeah, not confused necessarily. Confused about like basic grammar and how stealth technology works. Mm. And also toilets lately, but not necessarily morality.
That's according to what women tell him about dishwashers.
According to just, oh God. And so they go on, and to some extent this is about Trump, but it's also directed at evangelicals who will read this magazine. Up until they leave it because of their devotion to Trump. So I go to say, to the many evangelicals who continue to support Mr. Trump in spite of his blackened moral record, we might say this, remember who you are and whom you serve. Consider how your justification of Mr. Trump influences your witness to your Lord and Savior. Consider what an unbelieving world will say if you continue to brush off Mr. Trump's immoral words and behavior in the cause of political expediency. If we don't reverse course now, will anyone take anything we say about justice and righteousness with any seriousness for decades to come? And look, I've been very clear. I am a complete non-believer. I am just as lost and confused, I'm sure, from his point of view. And I don't know much. I did a little bit of research. I don't know a lot about Christianity today. But this is the sort of thing that I have wanted to see from people who hold their faith very close to themselves, respect it and believe that it should guide their life. Yes, you should be able to put those values above political concerns. I feel like Jesus was pretty specific about that. But a lot of people have really shown a preference for worldly advantages.
Yeah, it's, do you want guidance or do you want a leader? Like that's the thing. And the Bible and all those, all the source material, most of the source material provides you with guidance. Like ways and values, things to look toward, touchstones to say like this is where I'm grounded.
Yeah.
This is what should guide me in the life. And you should remember when they talk about the words of Jesus, they want you to remember the morals that they're teaching you. Mm. And a lot of people here are not, a lot of people in America are not Catholics, they're Protestants. And the Protestant thing was all about saying like, it's not the Pope who is this leader who is godly, it is Martin Luther saying, this goes back to you. The church is your church. It's who you are. It's the teachings of Jesus. Let's get away from this like blind loyalty to a leader in a palace thing.
Yeah.
And that's what should guide you. And I don't see why people have lost track with that for any other reason than something that is fundamentally not Christian.
Yes, I agree. Now, let's turn to something fundamentally not Christian. Our President Donald Trump, so he responded to this editorial from Christianity Today saying, a far left magazine or very progressive as some would call it.
Who are they? You have to cite your sources.
He means
now.
Himself as I would like some to call it. That's what he would like. He hates anonymous sources, Brett. He hates them and uses them, which has been doing poorly and hasn't been involved with the Billy Graham family for many years. Christianity Today knows nothing about reading a perfect transcript of a routine phone call. And would
not
rather
what they're talking about.
Have a radical left non-believer who wants to take your religion and your guns.
You're
than Donald
Trump.
They didn't say that. They didn't say that they want a Democrat to win in 2020. No president has done more for the evangelical community, and it's not even close. You'll not get anything from those Dems on stage. I won't be reading E.T. again. The novelization's not nearly as good as the movie anyway. Why read it?
No. It's the transcripts of Entertainment Tonight.
That's probably what
it is. Also, that probably was auto-corrected because he is always looking up what happened on Entertainment Tonight.
It might be. Here's the thing. So we like do our production in the morning of this, and I thought, oh, that's Trump weighing in on this. He's not done, because literally as we've been filming this, he's tweeted twice more. He says, I guess the magazine Christianity Today is looking for Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, or those of the socialist communist bent.
Like Jesus,
religion.
By the way.
Yeah, exactly. How about Sleepy Joe? The fact is, no president has ever done what I've done for evangelicals or religion itself.
I don't understand.
Golden calf? What are you talking about? That should be a deal breaker for evangelicals. He is lifting himself up to the heavens.
I don't understand for religion itself. I don't understand any of it. It's just hyperbole for its own sake. And it's so bad.
Yeah.
It's so bad. I can't even start with like the socialism of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Like the Lord your God, the Jewish one too, literally had the social program of raining bread from heaven to feed people. Yeah. Like, and then Jesus came in and was like, stop with all this merchant stuff in my temple. It should be a house of prayer, not a den of thieves. Stop all this.
Yeah.
Remember what the message is. And not who the messenger is.
Yeah. I worry that in this, I think they're gonna side with Trump. I mean, I know that Christianity Today is not like, that's not a core right wing magazine, so they don't really care about it anyway, but no, they want their victories on this earth, I think. They're thinking more about that. But I do appreciate what they wrote. And I will say, for those of you who might be big Trump fans or right wing evangelicals, I know that you're listening to me and you think, well, I'm a non-believer, I'm not a Christian, so why would you trust me? That should apply equally to Donald Trump. He's lying. He doesn't care about Christianity. He really, really doesn't. I'll at least say that I'm not a Christian and I don't think that it's true. But he will lie to you and pretend to believe what you believe. And that should be 10 times as offensive.
Or 2 times, as in 2 Corinthians.
Exactly. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, a guest is gonna be with us after this. Perhaps more so than in any election I can remember in races across the country, and in particular in Senate races, the Democratic Party has a number of choices to choose between. And in many of these cases, they have strong progressives that can be a stark contrast. The Republicans they're challenging, perhaps a big stimulus to new voters entering come election day. But will the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee back any of these progressive challengers, or will they stick with their strategy? Joining us now to break down the evidence so far is politics reporter for The Intercept, Akayla Lacey. Welcome to The Damage Report.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Very glad to have you here. I enjoyed your recent article on The Intercept about this topic. And it turns out that they are weighing in. What sort of candidates are they supporting?
So so far this cycle, the Democratic Senatorial Campaign Committee has endorsed 3 candidates who are former Republicans. They've also endorsed another candidate in North Carolina who is not a former Republican, but is very much the typical kind of moderate centrist, former, litigation attorney, former military veteran, who has loaned his own campaign $200,000.
Yeah, it's just interesting. I know that some of this is earlier, but it was just big news in the past week that Jeff Van Drew formally switched over to the Republican Party, which to me is sort of a warning that like, hey, let's make sure that the people that we're putting tons of resources in actually support the party. So anyway, let's talk about a couple of these individual cases that they're going. So Mitch McConnell is running for re-election. That's probably one of the highest profile races. Can you tell us a little bit about the person who's challenging Mitch?
Yeah, so Amy McGrath ran last year in a House race and lost pretty badly, but the DSCC thought they would give her another shot to beat Mitch McConnell, who is arguably their largest opponent in 2020. She's already had a couple of pretty serious blunders so far in the campaign, one of which was basically saying that McConnell was standing in the way of Trump's agenda. So the party has been trying to kind of clean that up a little bit. And there was some talk about a popular radio host in Kentucky potentially running against her. He hasn't, said that he's going to run, but there is someone who's running to her left. Pretty clear that DSCC is not going to back that person. But, Amy McGrath is the kind of candidate who put out a campaign video that showed the US military bombing people, but didn't have any policy positions. So that's the kind of people that the party thinks has the best chance of winning places like Kentucky.
So I feel in the last few campaign cycles, we've seen this strategy of putting centrists up against Republicans, and it has generally, in my experience, not worked. So far from what we've seen out of this individual race, does it seem like you've mentioned a couple of the missteps that she's had. I didn't understand at the time what she could possibly be talking about the stopping Trump's agenda. So far, does it look like that strategy is working? Do we have any idea of the early polling or anything like that?
I think, you know, she's doing well in polling. She's done really well in fundraising, but that's what happens when you have the backing of the party, because they can pull strings and get help for you. If they wanted to do that with a progressive person in this race, then, you know, it could be argued that they might be doing well in the polls also. But it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. That's the whole point about talking about who they're making endorsements for, because once you get the endorsement, your poll numbers increase, your fundraising increases, which then pushes you further in the polls and makes it seem like you have a chance of winning. So it's pretty unclear. I think nobody really thinks that Mitch McConnell is going to lose in Kentucky, but crazier things have happened.
And what about in Texas? John Cornyn is up for re-election. How are they weighing in that race?
So they recently endorsed MJ Hagar, who voted in, I believe, the 2016. She voted, I think, in 2016 as a Republican. I'm pretty sure that's the correct year. She has in the past made comments that are pretty anti-gun control. She's moved further left on that, which is also kind of a trademark of these candidates that the party tends to back, which is that oftentimes they might not actually have real convictions about the positions that they're taking, and they can kind of move with the as they feel the tide is turning on certain issues. So as the country has become more unified on what to do about gun control in the wake of countless tragedies, it makes sense that she's changed her tune on that. But at the same time, there are other viable candidates there, like Cristina Cintún Ramírez. Sima Hernandez is also running, but I know Cristina has been leading MJ, at least in most recent polling, and she's had a pretty impressive fundraising haul in the third quarter. Again, MJ is pretty far ahead of her on the fundraising front, but again, she's got the party backing.
Yeah, and you would expect that hypothetically, whoever they're going to back is going to do well, especially in Texas. Like you point out that Mitch McConnell's, he seems pretty safe at this point. But just, you know, in 2018, we had Ted Cruz, his race against Beto O'Rourke, and that was incredibly close. Like, this seems like it could potentially flip. It always seems that way, but it really does seem like it's moving in that direction. And so it feels odd that they're coming out in this particular way. I mean, I know that. Anyway, let's move on. I've made clear what I think about that strategy. I don't think that it's a wise strategy, and I don't know how free you are to opine beyond your reporting.
No, I'd like to make a point on that, though, sure. Which is that Cristina Ramírez was part of the backbone of people who led the organizing strategy that helped Beto almost beat Ted Cruz. So it's not like she's a nobody. She understands Texas really well. She understands how to mobilize communities that the party, frankly, hasn't necessarily had success mobilizing in past elections. So I think that it's kind of unfair for them to discount her on that point. And another point I would make is that, like you said, yeah, McConnell that's a reach seat. Texas is a place that's one of the targets that the party actually thinks they might be able to flip. And when we're spending so much time and energy and money talking about what's going to happen with the presidential election next year, it's been swept under the rug a little bit, not a lot, but that, you know, it doesn't really matter what happens with the White House if Democrats don't take back the Senate. So it seems kind of silly for the party to be making what look like callous decisions in areas where they could actually make changes that they need to put through the legislation that they've been working on for the past 2 years.
Exactly. And look, Kayla, I've really enjoyed your coverage of the campaign so far. Keep up the great work holding these organizations accountable. And thank you for joining us on the show today.
Thanks for having me, John.
We're going to take a short break, and then when we come back, what is a hate crime? One commentator in Britain would like to increase what's put under that umbrella in a particularly interesting way. And I believe that Brett and I are the perfect guys to opine on this.
I personally hate crime, so it'll actually work out.
I do. Okay, so this will be a little bit funny for you after this. A clip went at least semi-viral on Good Morning Britain recently with a commentator saying, that she thinks that a new term should be added to what we consider to be hate crimes to label someone. I've got Brett here because we happen to kind of be the thing that is at question. But well, hey, let's take a look at the clip and then we'll debate.
Very high IQ people are a minority group in society that are very much ignored and they're not understood and are largely neglected. So it is the case that individuals with very high IQ very often are bullied. At school, for example, they are a target for being bullied, often quite viciously. And I found that in my own research, as well as there's a lot of other research out there that documents this.
Obviously, again, you shouldn't bully people because they're different. But the reality is, if we're classing it as a hate crime to call someone a nerd or a geek, I think what it does is it trivializes actual hate crimes, you know, based on disability, race, gender. So obviously, again, as society, we need to make sure that we're welcoming everyone. But again, the term geek and nerd, et cetera, generally has been embraced. And if you look at technology, you look at the Mark Zuckerbergs, Bill Gates, the geeks and nerds, if you've like, was it Matthew chapter 5, verse 5, blessed are the geek, for they shall inherit the earth. So actually, it's the geeks who are leading the planet.
Stop. We need to clap for that. Blessed are the geek.
That was good. I liked good his one. Whole thing there. Really fast. I'm not all that familiar with a lot of morning television in the US, let alone in Britain. You always seem to be more familiar. Are you more familiar with Good Morning Britain?
Hate crime. No, I am somewhat familiar with Good Morning Britain. There's a lot of peers on it. Morgan.
Okay, so that gives you some idea of the sort of show it is.
But it's like watching Wheel of Fortune from other countries. Sometimes a clip of Wheel of Fortune from like Greece comes by and you see like it looks like they have a Pat in Havana, but like the words are in like the Greek alphabet or Cyrillic or something like that. But it's all the same. That's what it feels like to watch one of these clips. Because morning television is typically victims and recipes. And it just goes back and forth like so quickly that your head spins a little bit. But yes, I think this is ripe for morning television for you to sit there and look at an entire spectrum of subject from actually thoughtful topic to completely thoughtless topic and somewhere in the middle, which is where this falls.
Yeah.
It has the trappings of a thoughtful topic.
Well, yes, because.
But it is completely inane.
The topic is hate crimes. Sort of.
Yeah, that's exactly what I'm talking about.
Really? Yeah. Look, I will say, as a person who has been labeled at various times by others, a nerd or a geek, I've also self-labeled. I agree with the second commenter. Yeah, this just trivializes something that was specifically created to put necessary focus on something that was not being taken seriously. If you then expand that to everything, then you're right back at the status quo, which disadvantages certain people. And so I think we should be really hesitant to expand it to things like, yes, their bullying is bad, insulting someone is bad, you shouldn't do it, you shouldn't mock people for being nerds or geeks or whatever. I also don't think that a lot of people take that all that seriously outside of like, if a kid's getting mocked, fine, that's serious. But if somebody calls me a nerd on the street, I'm gonna be okay.
Yeah, but you're a grown up, and I understand, but just because it's not considered a hate crime doesn't mean there aren't already rules keeping people from bullying nerds and geeks, or calling people nerds and geeks who don't want that label put on them.
Yes.
I feel like there are some very intuitive boundaries that we all are tapping into when we hear that discussion, and I think a lot of people's intuitive boundaries line up with the guy who spoke after. And because also, like, a lot of these hate crimes are things that when they find out about you, you can't change them about yourself.
Yeah.
Like if it's a disability, if someone finds out about a disability, you can't.
It's intrinsic to you.
But like nerd, what that means, geek, those are such fluid concepts that have been repurposed to things that are actually cool again. And not to mention all like the trappings of a simple makeover, where it's just like that guy got a cool haircut and knows how to buy clothes and now he looks cool.
He does look cool.
Yeah. But it doesn't mean someone who is bullying a geek isn't a jerk.
Yes.
They're still a jerk and we should punish them, especially in a school setting and such.
I could not agree more. That's all the time we have. Thank you to everybody who's been reviewing the podcast recently. There has been a recent uptick in it and I really do appreciate it because it helps to get it out there and for more people to see it and hopefully for people to take it seriously. Like, we're online, so that's always difficult. Brett, as always, thank you so much. Watch Happy Half Hour, everybody, and I'll be on the main show later. So I'll see you then.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.